at this time to try and attempt to discuss what I feel to be some of the revolutionary dimensions of coalescency. Putting it in very simple terms, for those of us who are concerned about change, ways that we can get together to change things. At what points may this occur? First of all, I think we have to recognize the fact that we are now at a point in history where the term integration must be redefined. And from my own frame of reference and my own context, which I call the Black experience, I must see integration in different terms from what I had previously known it to be. Well, in many ways, integration only became a band-aid for the most serious disease that we had. And we fooled ourselves, really. For instance, there were those who advocated the melting pot theory, who said that finally we will be able, in our integrated thrust, to all become one. We will be fused together. That all of the races of people will be able to work and live in a hopeful situation. I remember one cat some time ago who advocated that in the next 500 years, if miscegenation took place, we would all look alike. And I began to think about that, and I said we'd all have blonde hair and blue eyes if we all looked alike. Now, baby, you know I'd have to do a lot of moving to get to that point, but anyway. Anyway, I kept thinking that. The melting pot theory. And then there were those who pushed the theory of what is called, of course, the what we call tokenism. The piecemeal theory, that every once in a while we are able to work with those kinds of people that will become acceptable to the degree that we're put two, three, as either showcase kind of participation or in a still an experience to some degree by which we can say that we are integrated, or we have some of them, you know, because we've got one or two. I shall never forget when we began to move very strongly in that I had just gone to San Francisco when a number of companies had begun to try to get Black people into their offices and into their workaday world situations. And most of the people that they got were what we call, in the Black community, high yellow, or light skin. I've got a little girl that my wife and I adopted, who's high yellow. We call her high yellow. She's, a father was Black and a mother's white. And she said to me just not too long ago, she said, Daddy, she's 5 years old. She said, Daddy, I said, what? She said, what does this mean? I said, Kimmy, don't put me on. You're trying to manipulate me. You know what it means. She said, yeah, I do. So that's like we're going to win, huh? I said, yeah. She said, what does this mean? What does this mean? I said, that's like we're going to win too, baby. That's the Black power sign, you know. So she said, a little later on, she's been a little bothered because mother and daddy are what she calls brown skin, are Black, and she keeps saying, I'm beige. I'm beige. And I said, well, Kimmy, you know, you could say you're yellow, too high yellow. She said, no, Daddy, I'm beige now. Don't mess me up. Evelyn uses the time, constantly uses the word mesmerize. Don't mesmerize my mind. So Kimmy got that, you know. She goes, don't mesmerize my mind, Dad, you know, this kind of stuff. But finally she says, Hey, she says, why aren't you and Mama my color? And we've been trying to talk about adoption, you know. The adoption agency told us to be sure to let the children know that they were adopted. So ever since she's been 5 weeks old, we've been saying, you're adopted, you know. But where she really gets it is she sees a television program, see? And they talked about an adopted, you know, the little boy or girl, whoever it was on that program, was adopted. And she comes back one day and she says, I'm adopted, like whatever program it was, you know. And that's the only time that I ever thought the television came through okay, you know, like it was really coming, communicating at that point. But interesting thing is she's worked through this. She's trying to work through it. And she's beginning to really understand it now. Very much so. Because we have all kind of cats coming in our house. And we're in a lily white section out there, you know. We're nothing but old conservative, and I have to say this, I don't mean that all conservatives were Republicans, but just Republicans. It's a dead neighborhood. It was, at least. But it's no more, baby. Because we got all those cats from the ghettos, you know, all kinds of ghettos coming out there constantly. Our place was ransacked not too long ago, and next door neighbor came over and he said, you just got too many people coming in here. We said, yeah, that's all right. We're going to keep them coming in. That's all right, you know. But anyway, so Kimmy's been working through a lot of this stuff. Well, interesting thing the other day, and then I'll move on. She was dancing, and kids come out quite often. Either we not too far from one of the high schools, just a block and a half, and they come down some days and skip class and come down and dance at our house while I'm away. I make sure I'm away, you know, I know what the cats are going to say if I'm there. But anyway, so she was dancing, and I said, put it there, baby, put it there. She knows what that means, you know. So she hit my hand, and I said, all right, that's right, you got soul, which I'm going to talk about later on. So she said, yeah, Daddy. She said, you know what? She said, I'm beige, but I sure am black, aren't I? And I said, yeah, you are. And she said, I got soul. I said, yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about this because I think this is what the black church has to give to the white church. And I want to get at this later on. Albert Outlaw knows what I'm talking about to some degree. We talked about it. If we're to rightly have integration, as from my frame of reference, it has to be where we have equal power, where we have equal resources, where we have equal possibilities. That's the only way we can integrate. Don't ever talk to me about integration unless it means that you see me and I see you as an equal. And we relate and respond to each other that way. Or else, forget it, baby. Like it's out, as far as I'm concerned. If we can work from that premise, then we've got something going for us. From now on. You see, part of the problem that we've had all along is that we've had great myths if you want to call it integration, I call it coalescency. A number of myths. Carmichael and Hamilton talk about some of these, and I want to outline a few that they talk about, then get it. Some things I feel strong about. And they say, first of all, that in the context of present-day America, the interest of black people, it is assumed that the interest of black people are identical with the interest of certain liberal, labor, and other reform groups. Those groups accept the legitimacy of the basic values and institutions of the society and fundamentally are not interested in a major reorientation of the society. Many adherents to the current coalition doctrine recognize this, but nevertheless would have black people coalesce with these groups. The assumption, which is a myth, is that what is good for America is automatically good for black people. That ain't so. That ain't so at all. The second myth is the fallacious assumption that a viable coalition can be effected between the politically and economically secure and the politically and economically insecure. Like the haves and the have-nots being able to coalesce behind issues. That this ought to occur. We ought to work for it. And it raises serious questions about the group that doesn't have the power, the group that doesn't have the power. Serious questions. Because we've seen this take place at points in certain sections and with certain groupings. And we know emphatically what's happening. Group that has the power is always able to win the battle on its own terms. The third myth assumes that political coalitions are and can be sustained, and I think this is where the church falls, on a moral, friendly, sentimental basis by appeals to conscience. We will examine each of these now at this time. First of all, the major mistake made by the exponents of the coalition theory is that they advocate alliance with groups which have never had as their central goal the necessarily total revamping of society, radical change in American society. At bottom, these groups accept the American system and want only, if at all, to make peripheral, marginal reforms within the society. Such reforms are not only inadequate, but don't have any significance as it relates to what we call racism in America. And this is why it's been difficult for us to win the battle. Because we have not talked about serious radical change in society to the degree where we've been able to coalesce, where we've all had as the primary goal this kind of achievement. There are those who still believe that we can make it if we just only offer certain small changes. Now, one thing I think I must say very emphatically, and that is, without any doubt, what you've got to understand is that most black people I know are not concerned about destroying American society. They want to change it, brother. Most of them that I work with are not like some of the white radicals that I know. Some of the white radicals that I know who say we are out, in fact, to destroy society, American society. We believe that we can change it. And I don't know why we still believe in that, but we do. The second myth we want to deal with is the assumption that a politically and economically secure group can collaborate with a politically and economically insecure group. Our contention is that such an alliance is based on very, very shaky grounds. By definition, the goals of the group who has the power and those who do not have the power are always quite different. Those who do not have the power are looking for security. This is one of their great needs. They need money. They need that kind of security, which moves them from a basis of being those kinds of people who are moving from a survival existence to that which would, in fact, bring them in an abundance of a different kind of life. The third myth, finally, proceeds from the premise that political coalitions can be sustained on a moral, friendly, and sentimental basis, and on those appeals, and on appeals to conscience. We view this as a myth because we believe that political relationships are based on, and here's the key, self-interest, benefits to be gained and losses to be avoided. For the most part, man's politics is determined by his evaluation of material good and evil. Politics results from a conflict of interest, not of conscience. What then are the grounds for viable coalitions? Before one begins to talk about a viable coalition, one should establish clearly the premise on what that coalition can be based. parties to the coalition must perceive, and here it is, a mutually beneficial goal based on the conception of each party of his own self-interest. One party must never assume that what is good for one is automatically without question good for the other, for instance. Black people must ask themselves, first of all, what is good for me? What is good for us? Which we have never asked. And then we can determine if the liberal is willing to coalesce. They must recognize that institutions and political organizations have no conscience outside their own special interests. Let me give you an illustration. Last year, when was the Democratic Convention here? Last year. They were getting ready to go to the Democratic Convention. When we got ready to talk about delegates to the Democratic Convention, all of a sudden they began to choose delegates, and no black people. How many times have you seen this take place? Now there we were, you know, integrated, and yet no black delegates. And then we got all the black people got up and marched out. See, we know what to do now. Got up, marched out, and formed a black caucus, and came back in and said, by any means necessary, baby, you don't go unless some of us are going, unless some of us go. And they all of a sudden decided, and these are white liberals now, got that, that they had to do something about it. And they said, one, what is it? Three. How many you got? That was our question. And they told us. We said, well, it seems like to us we ought to have just about as many as you do, at least half as many, you know. We got to come to some kind of grips with this thing. Well, that'll never work. Dr. So-and-so won't be included in it. Attorney so-and-so won't. Okay, nobody goes. Well, you know what happened. We won. We got to win the battle. Now, secondly, it must be generally clear that a power base, that there's no doubt about it, black people need a power base before they can begin to coalesce. And this is what we've been trying to bring up. The civil rights movement, in the main, provided, I think, a sort of a national sentiment and a national, I guess conscience, you might say. I don't know, but it did not provide a power base. We've just won a battle in San Francisco where I organized some black parents in Hunters Point. There was a kid who was bitten by fleas, child who was bitten by fleas, and I heard about this and called some of the parents in the community and said, you know, what are you going to do about it? And they said, what can we do? And we began to work around this flea-bitten child. And we came out, finally, with this demand, that there must, in fact, be a new school built on that premise. And they said, well, we haven't passed any bonds on it. We said, okay, we don't care. We want a new school, like, now. And if, in fact, the school is built, then we're going to sit down and plan it. You know, we're going to decide on who's going to construct that building, and we're going to help decide on what kind of classes are held in that building, and we're even going to talk about design with the technicians. So what happens? For a year, we went battle. And I shall never forget the night we went there, and they'd asked me to be the spokesman, as they did most times. But, and it was their determination, even though I manipulated them, I'm sure, at times, so I could. But anyway. Interesting thing that developed was the night that we went there for our big battle, the superintendent who was there at that time had sent a letter saying, we will not be able to build the new building because of all this jazz. So I really, you know, really worked on my, I spent hours on that talk, baby. I was ready, like really ready. We had hundreds of people. I got ready to speak, and I said, before I began my speech, Superintendent Spears, I remember that you sent me a letter indicating, he said, forget that letter, forget that letter. And, you know, I caught myself. He said, we found the money. Now, you know how I felt after all that time. all that time on that talk, you know, and that cat tells me, forget it, they found the money. Well, what they did is they chartered two planes and flew black people all over the state of California, letting them look at the schools in Beverly Hills and North Hollywood and all this kind of jazz. And they said, now you decide on what you want. They sat down with the architects and began to outline what they wanted at the school. It's going to be a model school for San Francisco. They're spending more money on that school than any that they've ever worked on. They also chose the architect and the construction company. They've also talked in terms of what kind of curricula they want. And they're now talking in terms of the faculty. Interesting thing is that they chose a white principal. It's very interesting. Because they trusted him, baby. That's why. They knew him. The one that they had there, they kicked. We got out. We got rid of him. Because I'm telling you, I've never seen a cat this bad. Finally, viable coalitions therefore stem from four preconditions. The recognition, first of all, the recognition by the parties involved to their respective self-interest. The mutual benefit, our belief that each party stands to benefit in terms of self-interest from aligning with the other or others. Third, the acceptance of the fact that each party has its own independent base of power and does not depend for ultimate decision-making on a force outside itself. And finally, the realization that the coalition deals with specific and identifiable as opposed to general and vague goals. The heart of the matter lies in these preconditions. Let black people then, first of all, organize and determine what their interests and goals are, and then see what kinds of allies are available. I think this is the transition we're going through now. You must remember this very much so, that the advocates of black power are not opposed to coalitions per se, but we are not interested in coalitions based on myths by any means, because we've had that monkey on our backs too long. To that extent to which black people can form viable coalitions, will we see meaningful and lasting relationships occur between all kinds of people? Now, having said that, it seems to me that this is what hopefully a church can become. And in a sense, this is hopefully what we're trying to do at Glide. I have certain convictions, first of all, to believe that Glide, since it is located where it is, so strategically, and this is what Klaus, I guess, was talking about, for me to get at, so strategically, right in the heart of the city, and yet right caught in the grips of not only one of the most blighted areas, but related to the social evils and problems and circumstances that we face, there's no area which can surpass it. For it is where the hard drugs, you know, like in that area, this is where we have the hard drugs. In that area, this is where we have alcoholism at its apex. In that area, it is where we have prostitution. I was saying to Joe Quillian and several others as we came over, talking about one of the projects, you go and Glide, and this is not suggesting that some of you might want to do this, but anyway, you go and Glide, and as soon as you walk out the door, you're easily propositioned, you see. And you may be propositioned by male or female. You know, it makes no difference, because it's the homosexual. You know, we're right in the homosexual ghetto. But one prostitute that propositioned a number of us who came out of the building several times. I tried to organize prostitutes about 2 years ago, but they're too difficult to organize. She had a groovy time with some of them, though. One in particular named Joyce, who we had worked with on a situation where she'd been beaten by a policeman, and she came in the office with one named Chicago, and they spent the day there, and they just took over our offices, which had a groovy time. Groovy time. Scared several of the ministers who came in there that day. Yeah. really tried to prop. Well, anyway, they took me down to the a building in the ghetto and said, "I want you to meet some of the friends." And we went down, about 30 girls that evening, and I started saying, "Well, you know, as I understand some of the problems you're facing, maybe we'll just try to get together and organize." But by the time we got ready for the second meeting, about half of those girls had moved on to some other place. You know, it's a mobile kind of situation. Anyway, they asked me for my card. I carried cards at that time. I haven't carried any cards since then. I gave them my card. I had about, I don't know. I used to carry a lot of cards around with me, you know, and I thought it was really something to carry a card. Anyway, later on, I got a call from one named Julia who said, "Hey, man." I said, "Yeah, this is about 4 days later. I met a man the other night who knew you." I said, "How'd you know he knew me?" She said, "Well, when I got him up in the room, I took out your card, gave it to him, said, 'Do you know this cat?'" He said, "Yeah, has he been up here?" Interesting thing is that I was saying to Joe Quayle that this prostitute had said to us after we had talked for a while and a few days, and then she began to come around and moved on inside of our place and from then on began to work with us. She said, "Yeah," she said, "I thought I was the one who was prostituting, but you cats prostituted me." Now, I think the essential thing that one looks at this, what we have is a base by which we need to operate. The church needs to be a base. We have now approximately 35 groups that come in our church every week, and none of them are church-related groups, per se. It needs to be that base by which all kinds of groups can come together and do that thing, whatever that thing is. That's one thing. The church needs to be a platform. Secondly, not only a base, but a platform for those causes which need to be amplified to the community. And as I see it, this is where one can get at such issues like, Channel 9, the educational television station, came and spent an entire day in a forum, or whatever you want to call it, on prostitution that we held at Glide. And that was the weekend that I got a threatening call. This was in November. Got a threatening call that, I don't know why the cat called me. Let's, you know, the pimps were very happy about what we did, because we had prostitutes who really talked about some of the problems, you know. I don't know what side this cat was on, but anyway, he called, and that was like Friday night. Saturday night, our place was burned. Some cat set the place on fire. It just burned about $7,000-$8,000 worth of building from the entrance, side entrance thing. But they got it out very quickly. I'm glad there's a fire station close by. So anyway, they got it out. That was also the next morning, that call that I got, where the cat said, we've already in the celebration, and we have a hippie who answers the phone on Sunday mornings, and sometimes that cat's not with it all together. And I thought, I said, "Well, we've had this before. We had threatening calls all the time." But he said, "You tell Cecil Williams that there's a bomb that's going to go off at 11:20. Well, it was about 11:15 then. You got to make a decision, Cecil. You know, what do you do at this point?" I said, "Well, if it's a bomb, I'm going to, the word, the message is going to go with it, so I'm going to get in these 5 minutes of preaching before," which I did, and I got to preaching and forgot all about it. And at 11:25, I looked at my watch and it was not there, you know? You know, nothing had happened. I said, "We're going all the way," which we did. But it can become that kind of base, it seems to me, by which an announcement is made about the issues of the city. I think the third thing, it can become, at this point, that kind of operation by which, well, we call them task forces, but those forces which can begin to relate and respond and initiate some of the important directions of the problems and solving some of the problems that people may be confronting in the city or in suburbia, wherever one may be. I think this can occur. Finally, I think it can be that group which can begin to organize to the extent that the church begins to deal with the realities of the use of power, but also the realities of the world in which we live. Because I firmly believe in eschatology. And I think that there's also other kinds of power which we have, my brothers and my sisters, that we don't even know about because we never used it. Did you know that? Did you know that? We have it, man, but we've never used it. We've been afraid to use it because we haven't believed in it, man. It's like we've never acted that way. It's like the only place we can learn about it is in seminaries, but we just learn about it. You see, it never really becomes a part of my total existence where I dare take the risk. You hear me? I dare take the risk to live it. You believe that the kingdom of God is coming, man, and that it's here? Why don't we act like it, man? Huh? You know why? Because we don't believe it. And we don't believe it to the degree that we can't act like it.
And die for it.
Yeah, man, that's right, and die for it. Exactly. Yeah, it means that we're going to lose jobs, and we're going to lose members, and we're going to lose a lot of things. Okay, a lot of cats saying, well, you know, Cecil, you have a unique situation there. You got money. You got a unique situation. I try to say a little something about, well, when I was in Kansas City, I didn't have a unique situation. I really didn't have money. And we were pulling off some things. We really were. I told the bishop, as I was saying to somebody earlier, that he would not recognize the place in 6 months, which he did. He couldn't have. That church was at it, you know, it couldn't go any lower. And they had closed the doors. What else could it do? You know, anything I did there would have helped the church out. And it glide. We only had about 75 hardcore people when I went there. And they were sitting up there talking about, the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and that one of these days we're going to all go to heaven, and all this kind of jazz. And I kept saying, what do you mean by this? They said, we heard our minister say it. That's what they really said. They didn't believe that themselves. It's a lot of stuff they were mouthing because they've heard it all their lives. People say that church is not going to make it. You know what they're saying? You not going to make it, and I'm not going to make it, man. Who's the, you know, who? Aren't we the church? Seminaries turning out cats every year. And we still hear the fact that we're not going to make it. And if we don't, it'll be because we don't believe enough to act like. I just have to put it to you the way the people tell me in the ghetto. First thing they say finally is this, hey, man, you from the church? I say, yeah, man. But you don't act like it. And I say, baby, the church you talking about, I don't want to act like it. I'm going to stop.
Because I'm going to start preaching in a minute.
Questions?
See something?
Yeah.
A moment ago, you referred to an intermarriage situation, and you spoke of the man having a white mind, experience, and the woman having a black experience. How do you feel towards intermarriage? And that's a hard question for me, but I hope you understand what I'm saying.
I was trying to think of how I used to answer that.
I don't want the typical answer. My
no, I'm trying to think of how I used to answer and how I answer it now compared to where I answer it now. Mark Comfort, who lives in Oakland and is one of the strongest black militants I ever met, is married to a black woman who happens to be white. You know why? Because she thinks and acts black. Now, what I'm really saying is she's had her mind deprogrammed to the extent that, man, she's right there with Mark Comfort. But not only with him, she's there also as a person. And she expresses it quite a different way. There are those, I want to be very honest with you now, very much so, if I possibly can. Blacks, especially some of the black militants who say, you know, we don't want our black and white intermingling to the extent that there's marriage taking place or that there's cohabitation or anything else you want to call it. But I noticed some of these very cats who will get on their brothers about dating white women will in fact date them themselves. And I tell them all the time, baby, don't play games. Don't play games. Stop playing games with your brother and with white people also. Stand up telling white people, we don't want to, you know, and all this kind of stuff when they know them well in mind.
How does this relate to the polarities you spoke of, by the way? That's what I was getting at.
Well, look at white radicals, for instance, in San Francisco, who moved to a position of, you know, just saying, here we are, wherever you want us to go, we'll go, and all of a sudden find themselves in a position by which they're being consulted with at points now and everything. And there was a sort of a marriage that took place because none of these cats were trusted at first. But it was when they moved in on the situation and did what the third world people were doing also, like putting themselves out, that something happened in that coalition. It was like all of a sudden everybody was coming from his own thing, forming another thing. Where they got arrested, where they got, you know, their heads beaten in, where they also were able to become a semblance of power as they moved in on that campus. So never forget, as we moved in day after day, how everybody waited until the blacks moved in. And when we moved in as a community, all of a sudden the black students got behind us as we moved in, and we led that thing. This is why violence, you know, what people call violence, which is throwing bricks and windows, and every once in a while setting off some few bombs. But we found out that some of the kids in the rightist movement also were setting off those bombs, making sure that those who were on the other side were being, you know, it was being said that they did it. But what I'm really saying is that there was a kind of coalition that took place which let each person do his own thing from his own frame of reference, but yet formed very, very, very significant kinds of relationships. And they were quite different from anything that I'd experienced in the civil rights struggle, by the way. That's the only way to answer, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I had the feeling that you were trying to say that in this, that a white person didn't have a chance to do his own thing.
No!
I've erased that now. Mm-mm. But that's what I was getting, and that's what I was trying to clear up.
What I often say is white people ought to do their own thing. You know, they got to do it. Like, I didn't want anybody, white person, to feel bad because all of a sudden I'm beginning to feel good about blackness. I want him to feel good about his whiteness, but not too good. You know, I just got mine going a few years ago. Yeah. Somebody. Yeah. Believe it or not, one of the best kinds of pressure to, weird way you can get to a school board is to organize parents, man, who got kids in those schools. Don't go get, you know, you got to make sure that when you organize the people who can really bring the pressure on. You know, I didn't go and organize young people because they were already getting together. I mean, at that time, somewhat. course, now they're really together in some of these high schools. Like in San Francisco, it's always something, you know. But what I'm saying is the real pressure had to come from those parents. But make sure, this has been one of the most fascinating groups I've ever worked with in my life. Because we have had so much pressure to try to bring upon the school board, we've never been involved in internal politics. And man, that's like something I never worked with before, because you know, cats are always vying for positions and all that kind of stuff. And who's gonna do this, who's gonna do that? No, not with this group. But the important thing is that these were parents who had kids in those schools. And they were able also, very interesting, as they moved along, they were able to bring in some of the white parents who were beginning to move, a lot of moving out of that area. And if they were still living there, they were sending their kids across the freeway to Fremont School because they were ashamed of that school and they couldn't do anything about it. So then we began to get some white parents involved, but mainly it was those black parents who were moving. Now that's one thing. We tried different kinds of strategy. One day, where we really got them, was one day we drew out all the kids in the school, and we were able to get all the kids out, and went down to the Board of Education meeting, and every 3 minutes, some 20 parents and students would come in together, and they'd walk right by the members of the Board of Education and just stop looking at them, you know. And just stay there for a little while and move on. And then here comes another group, you know. Yeah, man, that went on for about 2 hours. Other questions? Yeah.
I asked you before, you mentioned that your parish is 60% white and 40% black. Do you have any polarization in your parish, or how did you get your parish behind you, behind this task force?
Oh, God. I also said that 400 left, too, and that it's rapidly become young adult. Again, I don't know. I think it's where those cats are. That's just it, you know. The interesting thing is people are always asking me outside the church, how are you able to do it? I don't know. I really don't. Somebody asked me in New York the other week, what do your parishioners say about what you do? I don't know. I just know next Saturday we're moving in on a situation. They'll be there, baby, black and white. And if I want just the black ones to come, I say, just the black ones come. I think one thing, we've tried to be honest about this thing. And these are young, most of them are young people. Of course, we got some groovy old people, too. let me tell you, we got a cat there. Some of you may know him, Ed Pete, who's retired, but he's come to work for us. And he works with our senior members. See, we got 18,000 senior members right in that area where our church is located. And he's got about 400 old people organized. And they go up to, every week, they're up there talking to Reagan, one way or another. That's right. Every week, they don't miss a week going up talking to Reagan. And they also, man, at times they take young people. Sometimes they say, this is our, you know, just for the old people, our old thing. You young people stay. But sometimes they take the young people. They go up, play the guitars, sing on, they go up on buses, you know. And then the young people will work with them. But at times, the young people don't. I think it's because we sort of understand what's happening. At times, you work from that base of power which will give you the most influence, you see. Now, you know, even some of the members of the church who have been there 20 years, and I could tell you of some, it's very interesting. I don't know why they stayed on. A very interesting thing that developed is those who left, many of them who left, I had decided, I said, oh my God, the third Sunday I was there that I preached, I saw people getting up leaving. And, you know, of course, I try to relate very flexible, in a very flexible way. So at Glide, you know, nothing really surprises any of us that happens, to be very honest with you. But anyway, I was preaching, and a cat just stood up and said, Cecil, look, I want to try to answer the question that you've just raised. And I said, okay, man. So he tried, you know, and I said, I disagree with you here, but I think, you know, then another cat down here says something, and we started talking, and the first thing you know, we've got something going. And I said, ah, this is what ought to happen. So my mind began to spin, you know? And we never contrive it. A cat can stand up any time and raise questions. Or a cat can, you know, if he wants to talk. However, what I always do is make sure that I perceive who it is, and you got to kind of make sure you can feel the pulse beat of people, because you got cats who come in there on speed and all this kind of stuff. And you got to make sure. For instance, I know one cat who came in there on speed one day, and it just happened that I was able to look at him very carefully. I saw his eyes doing this, and I said, "No, you can't speak until you get your head clean, baby. You come back next week when your head's clean, and we'll talk, you know. But not like you are now. You're on a trip, and I'm not going to let you take me on your trip." You know? But this kind of thing. And I think the thing is that to a great degree, it's like we sort of understand how we're going to use glide as a power base in San Francisco. Somebody asked me, well, I'm in the mayor's office practically once a week, but not in there to hold his hand either. You know? And the chief's office, I was in there. I'll tell you this, I organized 4 months ago black policemen. Just black policemen. And like, man, the mayor says, "Don't do it, Cecil." I said, "I'm going to do it." And the chief said, "Oh, this is segregation." I said, "I don't give a doggone what you call it," and said that night. "Okay, what you call it, we're going to organize black officers," which we did. We organized black officers. Now, the interesting thing, these poor fools had been on that force for 18 years, some of them. Brother, you don't know what those cats had been through. What precipitated the organization was that two white officers were beating a black man. And one black officer went in and pulled out his gun and pointed it at him and said, "No more, baby, no more." Said, "I've seen it too long. And that's all I needed." See, because I knew I could get the brothers around that kind of issue. They wanted to save this cat because they'd been wanting to do it all their lives and were unable to. So we began to organize. We got the black officers organized. Now we got some white officers in the old black association. You see. Now, we went before the chief 3 weeks ago and sat down, and the black officer said, "We sent you our demands 2 months ago." The police commissioner also. Sit down with the police commissioner, and you know, chief didn't want me up there, but the all black officer said, black representative said, "You come on up." So I went on up there, you know. And when I got there, somebody said, "Cecil Williams is out there." And the chief said, "We thought it was just for black officers and all this kind of." And they said, "Let him in." Said, "He's our organizer." And I came in, you see. So we sat there and we talked about those demands. And the chief said, "Well, I've done this and I've done that and I've done this." Only thing he'd done is, get this. He'd announced who the chaplain was going to be. Chose one of the black people to be a chaplain. Black minister there. Boy, I'm telling you. But, so the commission, police commission says, in 2 months, we want to see how many of these demands you've met, chief. You got to move now, baby. Got to move now. Like appointments of officers. One, anytime he has the authority to appoint officers, he must never forget that there are black officers on his force, and therefore they must be appointed to high positions. Like, for instance, deputy chief, that's an appointed position. Like, for instance, they're getting ready, hopefully, to reorganize the police department where they'll open up 5 new appointments of what they call deputy chiefs in divisions. He's not to forget that, you see. Inspectors are also appointed. So appointed kinds of things. 2, that in regards to any complaints alleged against any officer, that it is to be heard by, they are to be heard by the commission. You see, a number of black officers had a number of complaints, but those that they had tried to bring out through what they call the district stations, by which then they went to the chief and the top brass, were never dealt with.
So now, these will go to the police commission, and they will deal with these allegations. The third thing is that officers are saying, black officers are saying now, we must win the respect of our black constituency, which means, in fact, that we would like and we must work in the black communities. Now, however, we would like for those white officers who are able to get with it to work with us. But for those that can't, forget it. That's what they're saying. The fourth thing is to put more power and influence behind the community relations unit. Now, we had a very, very, without a doubt, we had the top community relations unit 3 years ago, 2 years ago. The man who headed that community relations unit is now in Washington working for the National Community Relations Unit, Community Relations Unit, and was back in San Francisco the other day. If it were left up to me, he would be the chief, but it's not left up to me. Beautiful man, beautiful white man, beautiful white man. And I guess there was several other things that I can probably dig them up, but these are some of the things. I guess the important thing is that they are now convinced, for instance, I said to them a few weeks ago, look, man, you've got the black community behind you and a lot of white people behind you. Move. And they've really been moving at this point. And I think now they understand that they do have a semblance of power. They can win some battles that they could have won months ago, years ago, in fact. You see.
Yeah. In light of current conditions, what do you think about the merger of the black and white conferences in the South Central and Southeast?
I would say at this particular point, I just brought this up in Washington, D.C. last weekend. Number of the bishops were there, and I just, you know, I got to a point where I just had to say it. Since they didn't let me speak at general conference, I said, you know, the interesting thing about it is very few white bishops really know what's going on in the Methodist Church. I said, you are some of the worst cats I ever met in my life, you know? I did. I said, you know, you're really not with it. You don't know what's going on. Then I turned to some of the black bishops and I said, some of you cats don't know either. I said, I only know a few black bishops who really know what's going on and trying to do something about it. Now, I think the important thing that's rapidly occurring at this point is, and I was speaking to this point, in the conference, in the Florida conference, there was a merger between the black and white conferences. The black cats went in there and didn't ask for anything. Nothing. You know why? It was because one of those colored folks, Negroes, whatever you want to call them, sold off the black people. They told him, he's a layman, you know, we'll do certain things for you if, in fact, you cats don't ask for a district superintendency, or if you don't ask for a conference and staff jobs, or if you don't ask to be on program council, anything like that. And they didn't. And I said, now, if this sets the precedent for what's going to happen with every other conference that's going to merge, forget it, baby, because we're going to come in very hard about that. I'm talking about the Black Methodists for Church Renewal. And I'm going to talk to the white Methodists for Church Renewal and see what they can do about it, because we coalesced at the General Conference, along with some of the EU. You know, the Southern cats didn't know what was going on at General Conference for a long time. We had a hell of a coalition going on there. Did you know that? Really? That's right. That's why we won so many battles there. But, you know, you've never seen Satter White put down before like he was this time. Am I right about that, Doug? Well, Doug won't answer. All right, okay. That's right. That cat's never been a. And Lord Bishop Lloyd finally gets the guts to say, "I've been wanting to do this to you for years," and put it on him, man. That's right. Now, I think simply, my final word is just this. As long as we move toward what I termed an important, from my own frame of reference, definition of integration, which means that I come in with those equal possibilities, equal power, equal force to make it. That's all. That's all.
The black cats aren't about to do it. They aren't asking that.
I know it. But I tell you this, I give you my word. And I hope, Branson, you pass this on to the cats in Texas. We're going to come at them very hard. They're not going to forget it. And they're not going to do it finally because we got a commission that we've organized from the General Conference that has something to say about it from now on.